Welcome back to the swamp, my friends, and welcome if you're new. Now, today's video is going to be a bit different. It's going to be a compilation of stories sent in by viewers of the swamp, but narrated by my friend, Derek Weber. You can find the link to their channel in the description down below. I've been really sick recently, dealing with damages from the hurricanes. You know how insurance companies be, 100 people in and out the house, taking forever, and they really helped me get this episode out for you guys. So enjoy this extra long video of a bunch of stories we read over on the Dark Side channel. If you enjoyed these stories, be sure to subscribe down to Derek's channel. He does great stuff like this. And if you have a story you'd like to hear on the channel, be sure to submit it at swampdweller.net or the email you can find in the description down below.
My dad was a great guy. He was strong and kind. He thought about others before he thought of himself. He lived a good life, but his body and mind eventually failed. At the same time, my mother, who was also one of the most incredible people I've ever met, was diagnosed with cancer. They told her that she had between 6 months to 2 years, depending on how well she responded to chemo, how much rest she could get, and etc. After a few months, it became clear that my mom couldn't take care of my dad, as he was prone to wandering off, and I could only help so much, as I have a daughter who has special needs and had been through one heart transplant and would eventually need a second. Well, I decided that to give my mom and dad the healthiest, safest life, we would need to put my dad in a nursing home. I felt guilty, as we had never discussed his wishes before he got sick. Eventually, my dad lost his battle and passed away quietly. I was with him for 2 days straight in the nursing home. He kept hanging on for some reason, and no one knew why. I sat in his room on his last night, and I dozed off. The hospice nurse said that the second my head slumped down and I fell asleep, my dad passed away. He was waiting to die when I wouldn't be watching him go. I feel like he did that to protect me just one last time. We buried my dad just a few days later. The following day, Hurricane Ike sent terrible winds and storms throughout the East Coast, and my city, which was 1,000 miles away, was affected. Trees were torn down, and the power went out for 5 days in most of our city. That night, in complete darkness and absolute silence, I felt my bed shake. I looked up and I saw my dad sitting at the end of my bed. He, or I guess his spirit, sat there, just looking at me. He didn't say a word, but I could tell he looked sad. I didn't know what this all meant. Over the next year, he came to visit me several more times. He never said anything. He just looked sad. I did try talking to him, but he would just look at me and slowly fade away. About 2 years later, I got a wild idea to drive to the beach where he and my mom had taken me as a kid. I went by myself and moved the 13 hours to Florida town. By then, my daughter had been on a list again for a new heart, and my mom wouldn't have much time left. I don't know what possessed me to drive to Florida, but I did. I walked on the beach for an hour. I saw the sights, I smelled the smells that I had as a child, and then it hit me. I could hear my dad's voice. When I was a kid, he always said that if someone had to be sick in our family, that he would have it instead of them. At that moment, I felt calm. I knew he was telling me that for my mom, his loving wife, to survive, he needed to be in the nursing home. I also knew at that moment that soon enough, my daughter would get her new heart, and she and I would walk that same beach together. I drove home for 13 hours and collapsed into bed. I woke up in my bed shaking. It was my dad. But this time, he was smiling. He got through to me on some harebrained 26-hour round trip to Florida, and he let me know that I did what he would have done. He smiled, and I could hear him laugh as he faded off. I've never seen him again since. A few months after this, my daughter got her new heart. She has some of her grandpa's toughness and made it through like a champion. Sadly, my mom joined my dad and passed away 6 weeks later. But to the happy ending, my daughter and I made it to the beach a year later. We saw the sights that my parents had shown me when I was a child. While standing on the beach, looking out into the ocean, I felt the peace of knowing I had done all I could do for the people that I love. This next story is called Haunted Nursing Home Experiences. I originally got hired on as a CNA working the grave shift. The facility only had one nurse for the entire facility and one aide working per unit for graves. There were three separate halls. There were rehab and respite, long-term, and dementia. Well, during the graveyard shift, only low lights were allowed on. One over the nurse's station and one dim emergency light in the middle of the corridor. One particular night, a resident's call light went off. I looked at the board, and it was Emily. I walked down the hall until I got to her room, which was the last one on the right. I tapped on her door. "Emily, I'm coming in," I said in a tender voice. I walked over, pushed her call button off, and I asked her, "What can I do to help you?" "Beth, is that you?" I said, "It is. Is everything okay?" "No, I think a man is standing outside my window." Her curtains were slightly parted, and it happened to be a moderately windy night. I explained that to her. I pulled the curtains tight again and ensured that she could reach her call button. I told her goodnight, and then I walked back to the nurse's station. About 20 minutes later, a little buzz and a blinking light filled the air. It was from Emily. I walked down the long corridor and was in her room again. She said in her small, frail voice, "Tell that man to stop walking by my room. I don't like it." I told her I didn't pass anyone in the hall, but I'll check the rooms to see if anyone's awake. "Could you see what he looked like?" She reported only being able to see a black silhouette. I filled her water and left her bathroom light on so it glowed under her door, giving her a little bit of a nightlight. As I walked back, I popped my head into the other resident's room, looking for evidence of somebody being awake, but no luck. I returned to the station and told the nurse what Emily had said. Her response was, "They're all crazy, and Emily just tends to be needy." I thought that was a little heartless, but this was my first nursing home job. I didn't know much. The registered nurse left for the other side of the building to check on additional staff, and I was left alone. Soon, a humming sound and blinking were on the board. Emily's room. I was kind of bugged. I thought that the nurse was right about this resident just being needy. I looked down the long, dim hallway and a shiver ran down my spine. Weird, I thought. I drifted towards her room and leaned over her bed to turn her button off. "Emily, what can I do for you?" She kept eye contact and mumbled something. "I can't hear you." I leaned closer. She feebly said, "He's standing in the corner by the foot of my bed." Hot shivers shot down my spine, and that feeling fixed itself right in my lower back, along with a heavy, sick feeling in my stomach. I couldn't bring myself to look. My head started to feel light. "Emily, let's say a prayer." I knew we were of the same faith. I held her hands and kneeled. I prayed that she could sleep well and that anything dark in this room would leave. I closed the prayer and she said amen. I sat with her a little longer and she said that the room felt lighter and that it was okay for me to leave. I walked back to the desk station and the rest of the night was quiet. I'll never forget her or that experience. And as I've gotten older and had other supernatural experiences, I've noticed that if something dark or evil or even demonic is present, I will feel that same feeling in my lower back. Does anyone have any theories why? I mean, is there a connection between the spine or other nerves and the paranormal? Our next story is called The Little Ghost Boy. Okay, so this is my first time writing one of these, but anyway, I worked the night shift at a dementia nursing home as a nurse aide in Texas for 2.5 years. It would get hushed at night whenever we were done with our shift change reports and our chores and our first rounds. I always felt like I was being watched, and not just by the cameras on the floor. I would walk around to check on my residents to ensure they were okay, and every time I did, it felt like I always had an extra person with me. Even when I had a coworker or nurse actually with me, one of my residents would ask where the little boy was almost every night. I would always ask, "What little boy?" And they always described the same thing, down to the clothes and his age. All of these residents were in separate halls and never interacted with each other. Another time, my mom, who also worked the same shift, told me that one of the residents was still of sound mind when she was doing rounds. They told her about a little boy who was visiting him in the room and was sitting in the armchair in the room conversing with him. My mom was shocked because there was no one else in the room and nobody was sat in the chair, to which the resident said my mom had sat on him. Of course, there was nobody there. My mom is sensitive to these things, and she would always feel a presence in the building no matter which hall she worked on. But, of course, I don't feel them like she does. Every time that little boy would appear or make himself known, a couple of residents would pass away 2 or 3 at a time, just a couple of days apart. After giving, Mom would open the windows and pray so that they could pass along to the afterlife and not be trapped in the building or in their room. Later, we learned from other co-workers about the little ghost boy who would visit residents before they died. Nobody knew who he was or where he came from, other than he had been there since the facility was built. I was never able to find out who he was or where he came from. Some nurses and nurse aides thought he was a precursor to death, an angel, or maybe even death himself. I like to think he was a messenger or a guide, letting them know that it was almost time.
On February 24th, 1999, Michael Ruiz would be accidentally killed in a fight with one of his fellow sanitation engineers outside of their workplace. The death was ultimately judged as an act of self-defense. The other member involved in the altercation stated multiple times that he was attacked from behind by Ruiz. The two men who witnessed the fight agreed with the defendant. One of them said later, "He pounced on Tony, which was the defendant, like a rabid animal possessed him. I'd never seen him act that way before. Tony had no choice but to fight back. When Mike went for his eyes, it was obvious that this had become a fight for his life." On the evening of his death, the police carefully searched Ruiz's home, hoping to discover a motive for the attack on his coworker. What they would find shed light on the inner mind of a man in the depths of psychological collapse and the events that led to it. Unknown to anyone other than the officers there that day and Ruiz himself, Tony Campbell, the defendant, had prevented a terrible act of bloodshed from happening a mere 2 days later. The following paragraphs come from a notebook of papers written by Ruiz. It documents the awful plan he soon set into action and the unfortunate events he felt justified to strike out against his enemies. Although a few names of people and locations may have been changed or omitted altogether to preserve their privacy, all pertinent information surrounding the above actions has been left intact. Now, I present to you what all the media entitled The Bloody Plan of Michael Ruiz and the Poor Excuses for It. My young life was as average as any other's, I suppose. I was bullied just like anyone else. Even though I despised it at the time, it would be my first lesson in power dynamics. It's not often discussed, but we eventually learn our place in the pecking order. No doubt my bully had been bullied by someone else in his life. He was just simply paying it forward for me to learn my place in life just as he had. In college, the professors take the side of the bullies and use their superior position in the school. Once our real life truly starts, our adult one, as long as we remain among our people, no one should have any reason to knock us back into our place. The only part of our lives this may differ is at our workplace. They're nothing more than a more severe form of school, anyhow. Your boss should be the one person who can be in the right to correct you, unless he's nothing more than just another one of your peers with a fancy title. At that point, he's on the same level as you and should, by all rights, keep his mouth shut. From the first day I learned this unfortunate lesson, I lived by this rule. I was confident that as long as I remembered my place and stayed in it for the remainder of my life, I'd have a decent one. However, on February 26th, 1998, I discovered that no matter how hard I worked, loved my family, or said my prayers, I couldn't prevent my daughter's death. The verdict was SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. What kind of answer was that? It in no way tells you actually how she died. It seems to me just another way of saying, we don't know. I was ready to end it when that happened, but fortunately, I still had Heather. Everyone around us said that we'd make it through as long as we stuck together. You know, time heals all wounds and the rest of that empty garbage. She didn't even wait 3 months before she left. Something about my suffocating grief, whatever that's supposed to mean. For the second time that year, I decided to check out. But the same people gave me the same platitudes. Although I had no real reason to listen, I did. Some force inside me drove me forward. Perhaps I had attempted to get above my station in life and become too proud of my things. So I believed them when they told me to let time do its thing. It hadn't been more than 5 months since my life began to collapse before my coworkers began mocking me. As with other problems, I believed this treatment to be a reminder for my peers that I had let my pride take over. Over time, though, the barbs and banter began to take a tone of vindictiveness, and I took my concerns to my supervisor. Instead of the support that I had expected, he made it clear that I was somehow responsible for this treatment. This was when it finally clicked in my head. It wasn't myself that had lost his way. It was those around me who had become eaten up with pride. I could see it now. Fancy cars, expensive vacations to the Bahamas. We were garbage men, for God's sake. I would be responsible for reminding them how far they had strayed. The following months flew by quickly as I first formed my plan in my mind and then put it into action. Any free minute I had was used to create in my mind and then build with my hands. As the days grew closer to my deadline, I feared I wouldn't finish my work in time. But if you're reading this, I have and am no longer here to suffer. If you wonder why I chose the 26th as the day to execute my plan, I figured the anniversary of the day I lost my Anita was no finer a time to remind my peers of how far they had strayed. Suppose the two bombs that I've planted at the administration building didn't manage to destroy some, in that case, if not all of my coworkers, my supervisor included, then I'm more than confident the one I planted at his home will at least kill the man who has almost lost his way and was responsible for this entire path of retribution I have been forced upon. Ultimately, I'm only comforted by the fact that I maintained his proper way of life. I pray there is a place that I may be together with Anita once more. Do not damn me for what I have done. I have simply taken upon myself a task that no others dared to undertake. This next report is called Garbage Day Horror, and it's submitted by Anonymous. All of these happened to me while I worked for a large city close to where I grew up, in Texas. Some are more gory than scary, but I promise they're all 100% true. Besides, it's a subject I know a lot about. I'm writing these stories to give the world an insight into a job that most people, especially upper-class ones, don't know much about. Growing up in a blue-collar family in a small town in Texas gave me a positive view of hard work. Despite that, I've always had a more intellectually learning mind. In middle school, my biggest dream was to visit Japan after graduation. And by high school, I wanted to be a criminal psychologist and interview serial killers. Never ended up doing either. See, I've always been a sluggish person. Although I could do most of the challenging schoolwork, except for math class, the calculators were always my best friend, I usually preferred taking a nap on my desk. Because it was the easier path, I quit school my senior year and got my GED. I was going to have to slog it out at a junior college before I moved on to a university, but I didn't mind. I hated high school anyway. 2 weeks later, I'd taken my money out of the college and used it to move to Austin with a few friends. I had a great time there, but because of problems that I had created, I was back at home by 1995. I continued bouncing around Texas every few years until around the year 2000. Through a childhood friendship, I end up with a job working for a large Dallas suburb as a garbage man. The technical name was sanitation engineer, but I wasn't fooling myself. I was handling people's trash. As I said earlier, I grew up in a working-class home and had no problem doing manual labor. The aspect of the job that made it so appealing was the pay. Of course, I couldn't afford to live in the city that I was working for, but I'd still be getting the same income that my father had taken 20 years to get. And that was just a start. This was at the time before the economy began to take a downturn. We were given full benefits and had guaranteed raises once a year. It was indeed a dirty job, but for a 20-something kid with a GED, I was ballin'. Perhaps even better was that my girlfriend didn't mind at all. A more accurate description of her would be excited. After all, we were leaving our rinky-dink town and living in the heart of one of the largest metropolitan areas in the country. Looking back on it now, life was pretty good. We'll get to my first story with all the formalities out of the way. This initial tale takes place a few months after 9/11. In hindsight, this was about the time things began going downhill financially for us city employees. My partner and I were working our usual route. In this particular city, we still did things the old-fashioned way. We didn't pick up trash cans, but we put bags in the back of the truck ourselves. They were supposed to stay under 50 pounds, but it was common to come across one close to 100. My three bulging discs are proof of that. But I digress. Anyway, it was my turn to pull trash. At one specific stop, I picked up a bag and noticed it was full of books and videotapes. Being a book fanatic myself, I had to see what was in it. After I cut it open, I knew I'd hit pay dirt. A big black trash bag full of spotless goodies. To make a little extra money, many of us guys would sell any valuable items that we came across on our routes. Whatever books that I didn't keep for myself would go to a store called Half Price Books. Before deciding what to keep, I waved my partner to the back to choose if he wanted any for himself. As we sifted through the bag, we noticed a theme forming. Almost every book had something to do with warfare or something in history connected to it. Among them was an excellent volume of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, A History of the Third Reich, and the notoriously anti-Semitic fraud of a book called The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, a fake first published in 1903 in Russia, telling of a global Jewish conspiracy to control the world through the press and other media. If this sounds familiar, it's because it's the progenitor of all the crazy global Jewish conspiracies we hear today. It was also taught in the schools of Nazi Germany, so there's that too. Although this already sounds strange, there were also multiple copies of a video with Arabic script and subtitles in English called Children of Fire. At the time, this didn't mean much. However, considering the recent attacks and the shutting down of a local charity, we were unsure if we had something connected to the two. My partner and I shared a horrified look. What had we just stumbled upon? I think any American could be forgiven for putting two and two together, but the fact was, we weren't supposed to be digging in these bags. It wasn't a privacy policy, more of a you should be working, not digging sort of thing. Even if we felt they were throwing these tapes out to hide something, that was the facts. We both knew, regardless of whether this was objective evidence of something, if we called law enforcement, we'd get chewed out by our dim-witted bosses. After thinking about it for a moment, I decided I'd take a small selection of the books and videos and hold on to them in case something occurred down the line. And that's just what I did. Now, we move forward in time. It may be a year later, or maybe as long as 2 years. I don't remember really, but I'm loafing around my apartment on a day off and happen upon one of the videotapes from that bag. This tape is a blank TDK or similar brand VCR cassette. On the top of the cassette, there's a white label with something written in pen. I don't remember exactly what it said, but it was something like 60 minutes and then some date ending with 1993. I'd always been curious about what was on it, so I finally put it into one of my VCRs. The report that followed made my jaw drop. The information was a story from 60 Minutes sometime in the 1990s about the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and the investigation to find those involved. It wasn't remarkable until a picture of a certain videotape titled Children of Fire popped up on the screen. Part of the report stated that the videos inspired some of those involved with the bombings. It was a documentary by a Palestinian woman recording the training and fighting of the Palestinian state against Israel. This made my mind flip back to that day. Why in the world would a person own videotapes documenting attacks against Israel that inspired acts of terrorism against the U.S. and owned multiple books about warfare, anti-Semitism, and the history of the Nazis, only to throw them into the mere garbage days after the second attack of terrorism against the World Trade Center? I had my theory, but had I also destroyed evidence that could have helped implicate them as being involved somehow, or at least showed them as outright supporters of international terrorism? I broke out into a cold sweat just from the thought. I had saved a couple of books and that videotape, but ran maybe 20 more books and tapes into the truck. I'd been almost catatonic for some time before my girlfriend entered the room and broke me free of my stupor. The following days were lived in a fog of regret. Then, not long after, it all came full circle. While listening to the news one afternoon in the truck, I was reminded of that little charity that had been closed around September 11th. A self-proclaimed local charity called the Holy Land Foundation, run by Palestinian Americans, was on trial for providing material support to Hamas and related offenses. To be more exact, the prosecution's theory was that HLF distributed charity through other local charity committees located in the West Bank that paid stipends to Palestinians who targeted Israeli civilians or to their families if they committed suicide during the act. That Hamas controlled those Zakat committees and that by distributing charity through Hamas-controlled committees, HLF helped Hamas win the hearts and minds of the Palestinian people. By 2008, all the defendants had been found guilty on all counts. If you haven't got it yet, the freedom fighters shown in Children of Fire were part of Hamas. Hearing this report transformed my guilt into utter terror. The odds were high that my partner and I had destroyed things. While not indicative of supporting terrorism, it indeed showed a blatant pro-militant attitude towards the state of Israel and those who were on their side. I didn't even want to consider the number of problems we would have if this came out. For the next 4 years, until the Holy Land Foundation defendants were convicted, I didn't want to have anything to do with any discussions about the Middle East. Their conviction would allay my fears, and I would sell the books I took that day over time. My mind would gradually move away from that miserable period. However, you can likely tell from this story that it hasn't completely disappeared from my subconscious mind. I would receive a career-ending injury within 6 months, and my priorities would drastically change. As a wrap of this particular story, I want to stress that I did not then or now have any concrete proof that the owner of the house or the things in the bag belonged to anyone connected to the Holy Land Foundation. Nonetheless, suppose you were to put the recent happenings in the world and the fact that a local Palestinian charity was being prosecuted for supporting terrorists. In that case, I'd wager 9 out of 10 Americans would have jumped to the same conclusion that I did. Now, with this story complete, we move on to the next. Perhaps it will be the account of the clumsy trash man, or maybe even the tale of the man who yelled heart attack. Not even I know. Our next story was submitted by another anonymous user. I had just moved to a new state. I got in my car, I was still rocking plates from my old state, and I started my drive to work. We had a long driveway in my apartment complex that you had to turn onto, meaning you couldn't see if a car was coming down. The garbage bins were also in the parking lot, so the garbage truck had to drive down our long, blind driveway to get to the cans. I was most of the way down the driveway when a garbage truck pulled up. He had pulled one tire partially onto our driveway, and I had clearly pulled into it first as I was at the end. I thought I was doing him a favor by not making him back up and I could easily go around him. But this set him off. I was driving away and he got in the truck. He followed me and he laid on the horn without stopping for a solid 20 seconds. I'm waiting to turn off my residential street and to get onto the main road. He follows me for a bit closer and then turns the other way. I figure I'm free. I then go to turn from the next major road onto the highway. It's rush hour in a major city and there's tons of traffic. When I get to the next exit, the garbage man pulls into the highway. He cut me off and stopped dead in the middle of the busy highway so that I couldn't drive. Since he was driving a big garbage truck, I was able to get away. I told my apartment what happened because I wanted to make sure that they had cameras on my car in the parking lot since it was quite recognizable with the out-of-state plates and the garbage man knowing where I lived. The building manager said that they'd had another woman complaining about this guy and asked me to file an official report. I said no because this guy knew where I lived. I'm somewhat weird about social media these days. I used to really be into Facebook when I first moved to college. It kept me in touch with my friends and my family back home, and it was nice to feel like I wasn't so far away from them. Building up a collection of photos, checked into places, and sharing every little detail of my life so that everyone could see how great I was doing, my entire world was online for all to see. And because I'm dumb, I was pretty liberal about my privacy settings too. So, one day, I got this message request from someone that I'd never heard of before. It just said, "Hey." I checked their profile to see if they were in the same class as me or anything, but it turned out that we had no mutuals and they lived on the other side of the country. So, as you can imagine, I'm pretty confused as to why they're messaging me, but I'm also curious. So I replied, "Hey man, do we know each other?" I don't know what I was expecting him to say when I saw that he was typing a reply, and I remember thinking that maybe he was looking for someone with the same name as me or something. But then his response popped up, and all it said was, "I'm going to kill you," with the cowboy emoji at the end. I stare at the message for a few seconds, not scared at all, really, just like, what the hell? I mean, the cowboy emoji was weird enough, and then I looked at this dude's profile, seeing a bunch more pictures of him shooting a gun and wielding knives in the woods. I mean, that was at least a little intimidating, but what got me were all these rants that he'd posted about how much his life sucked, or how unfair things were, and how he'd love to take it out on someone who deserved it. That, and the unplayable videos that Facebook had removed but still had captions like, "That chainsaw goes through his neck like butter," with the crying laughing face. That's when I started to worry. It didn't seem like this guy was just having fun, playing a prank on a stranger by trying to scare them. He seemed legit crazy and seriously angry. That nutcase could have been studying every one of my statuses, my picture posts, and check-ins for weeks before he decided to message me. He could have screenshotted all my stuff too, so it didn't matter if I had blocked him or not. He had my name, my school, where I hung out, the terms of all my friends and my family. He had everything. I thought maybe that I was just making a big deal out of nothing at the time, but later on, I could barely sleep just thinking about it. How horrifying a thought it was that he could have been driving across the country as I lay there in bed, having just picked a person at random to kill, and being crazy or angry enough to do it. You can call me paranoid all you like, but I just couldn't get this guy out of my head. Like, the idea of him hunting me down or whatever was frightening enough. I mean, he had enough info on me to be able to ambush me at a dozen different places that I just couldn't avoid because they were school or the grocery store or just my dorm room. But what had freaked me out is that creep might have been able to learn so much about me, and I was dumb or vain enough to let it happen in the first place. I knew that the internet was full of crazies, I did, but I didn't expect it to reach out and touch me like this. If I didn't make it clear already, I did block the guy, but some weird, grim curiosity had me unblocking his account one day, so, I don't know, I could sort of check up on him and make sure he wasn't about to do anything too nuts. There were no rants or threatening statuses, just a long series of photo posts that made me think he'd taken up photography or something. I'm scrolling through them when I get to this familiar feeling from looking at the scenery in this particular photo. I couldn't be 100% sure, but I'd swear that many of the pictures he'd taken were of things around the town I was living in. There were no street signs or anything. There was nothing to confirm that he'd actually driven across the country, but if he wasn't taking pictures in a town that looked remarkably similar to mine, I could have been in a lot of trouble. I expected that guy to jump me for weeks, like I was a complete nervous wreck. It messed with my sleep, I lost a bunch of weight, being in an almost constant state of anxiety for the better part of a month. He didn't find me and nothing happened, thank God. But just knowing that he could come and get me at any time he liked got to me in ways that I never even imagined it could. We put ourselves on Front Street in a big way with social media, and there could be anyone out there just lurking on our profiles. So, like I said, now I'm somewhat weird and cautious about social media. I don't put too much out there anymore. I don't use my real name, and I run the strictest privacy settings possible. And I recommend that you do, too. For privacy reasons, I won't use real names. Alright, so here it goes. I downloaded an app to meet new friends. It's open to all, and you can meet anyone from anywhere. I matched with a woman, and I'll call her Cora. She's 31 years old, and she said she's from Australia. I'm 21, and I'm from an Asian country, and meeting people and being friends with them is absolutely what I love, no matter how old you are or where you're from. So, meeting Cora is not something special for me. Although she is the only one that I matched, her age is like a mom. Anyway, I said hi to her, and she replied with a long message, telling me that she wasn't from Japan and that she was from Australia and wanted to be my friend, and that she was sorry. Now, I'll tell you real quick that in my bio on that app, I said I wanted to meet Japanese friends because I'll be visiting there later this year. I wanted to meet them and to hang out, but I also stated that I'm open to other nationalities because I just like meeting new friends. It's cool to have a friend from a different country, you know? At least, for me it is. Well, getting back to the story, she kept saying she was sorry for not being Japanese and wanted to be my friend. I said it was okay and that I would still be her friend. I asked her about Instagram so that we could continue to talk there, and she said, "Why not Facebook? Are you hiding something?" I was shocked. Like, why the heck are you saying that? And the first red flag started to slap me in the face. I said, "No, it's just that I'm much more active on Instagram." She said that she wanted to be my friend maybe 1,000 times, and I'm not gonna lie, I'm freaked out. I then kept chatting with her because, I don't know, I didn't want to be rude. The messages just became creepier, and I started to feel uneasy and wanted to stop. So I did. I figured that we had just met, and I didn't tell her anything personal about me, so there shouldn't be any problems. Right? Wrong. After an hour, I received a friend request on Facebook from Cora, which sent chills down my spine. How did she find me? I didn't give her my full name, and I was using my nickname on the app. I blocked her, and over the next 30 minutes, she followed me on Twitter and Instagram. I stopped her there, too. I was starting to panic. What if her profile was fake? What if she was a poser? What if she actually lives near me? What if she tried to harm me? Stuff like that, it just started to blow my mind. I then decided to delete my profile in that app, and I stopped using it for a while. It's been a month since that happened, and I low-key freak out whenever a Cora name pops up on my screen on several social medias that I use, like the who to follow thing on Twitter and the friend suggestions on Facebook. Maybe someday I'll download that app again, but I'll be cautious about communicating with strangers. I don't know how to talk about this, or even what it was, but maybe you could give me some insight or understand something that I'm not. Also, I'm sorry for this being so long of a post. I was 20 when this happened, and I'm now 22, and a 5-foot-tall, brown-haired, blue-eyed, toned girl. Here's a bit of a backstory. When I was 15, I started a fan page on Facebook in which I'd post photos of my cars and articles and pictures of vehicles, and I'd do write-ups on them. I ended up having somewhere around 13,000 followers on my Facebook fan page, and many found my real Facebook name and started adding me there. 15-year-old me thought how cool I felt becoming more known in the car community, so of course, I accepted all requests that I got. This guy Rob added me on Facebook as well, probably when I was about 17. Now, I mentioned that part for this reason. He was in America, and I'm in Canada. I had people from all over the world add me. When I was 20, he started messaging me on Facebook, saying how beautiful of a woman I've become and how it's been a pleasure for him to watch me grow, and how my boyfriend is lucky and should marry me already. Those comments made me uncomfortable, but I brushed it off as him just, you know, being nice. He continued to message me and I would respond. He then started telling me how he could improve my life if I moved to the USA. He could get me to be a model at SEMA shows, And for those who don't know, it's a massive car event, and how he could get me up on the stage at Barrett Jackson, which is another big car event, and be paid $20,000 per show. He told me how I could be rich, and that he's also helped other girls this way. I told him that I'd love to model at those car events, but I can't leave my boyfriend or my career, and I don't want to marry him, so I'd have to pass. This was when it got extra weird on his part. This girl, Amber, added me on Facebook, and I accepted because they were mutual friends. I did some excellent old Facebook stalking, and she seemed pretty normal, but also like a fake setup account that's been around for a while. I then got a message from her saying how Rob told her that she should show me that what he had promised me was accurate and that she would be my friend so that I wouldn't have to be alone when I moved, which is how she put it. She showed me her house through pictures, and she said what he's done for her has made her very, very rich. She showed me her cars and her modeling pictures too. I asked what she had to do, and she told me about the car shows and a few extra things here and there. I asked her what the few extra things were. She told me that I might think it was gross and that I might lose respect for her, but I told her not to worry. She then told me that she shoots porn for him and that he treats her well, and if I want big money, then I can do that too. She even tried convincing me to send her some photos of me so she could see if I'd be right for it and if I'd have the guts, as she put it. Now, this fucked with my head, and I don't even know why I kept talking to her or him at this point. He would then message me, still trying to convince me, telling me how I needed to leave my boyfriend and that he could improve my life. The girl Amber went as far as adding my dad on Facebook and talking him up like she and I were good friends when I barely knew her. She also would message me trying to encourage me to live their way, and she told me that I could even live with her until I get my own place. Rob also asked if I'd send him videos and pictures of me, and he would send me money on PayPal to prove that he would stick to his word once he came out to get me. It got to the point that I felt so scared that I remember telling both of them just to fuck off and leave me alone. Amber told me how this is a lifestyle that she can't get out of once I told her off, and she even told me that she gets abused, but that's the way it goes once you're in, and it's usually because she deserved it. She called me all sorts of nasty names for, quote, bailing on them, and belittled me for not going with them. I even asked if she needed help, and she told me not to ask her these kinds of questions. She told me not to piss Rob off by blocking or ignoring him, and that he would send his guys after me. I told her, you know what? Send your fucking guys. I don't give a shit. She told me to watch myself, that they'll find me and kill me or even rape me if I don't listen. I told her I screenshotted and reported them to the police, and I asked if they wanted me so bad just to end my life because, you know, I hate it anyways. I thought that by saying this would throw them off a little bit. I blocked her, and then I was re-added by some new Facebook girl. She threatened me through Messenger before I even accepted her friend request, which I never did. Apparently, she was their friend. I broke down and I finally told my boyfriend everything, and I hid this from him as I was scared shitless. He blocked any accounts that they had, and I never reported to the police because that was just a threat. I wish that I did though, but I was so scared. I told the other girl who added me that the police were looking into this and to leave me alone. After that, they just disappeared. There were so many more really fucked up conversations that they had with me, but it's just so much to write, and it makes me anxious. I told some of my friends, and they think that this was some kind of human sex trafficking. I don't know. Nothing came of it, and I'm still here today, but it made me wonder. And I'm terrified to go to a SEMA show someday, worrying that she maybe really does model there. What if I did meet up where they wanted to meet in Canada? Would I be another missing person? You can call me Tay, I'm a 28-year-old male. I work for a food delivery service in Utah, and I work between the hours past midnight. I'm a medium and a magnet for all things supernatural and strange. Because of this, I have a set of rules that I try to stick to complete my deliveries safely. The rules are as follows. 1. Trust your gut. 2. Never stay outside the car for more than 1 minute. If more than 1 minute is needed, be in a well-lit area. 3. If you have passengers, they stay in the car. 4. Never touch animals that you might encounter. 5. Only speak to those necessary for work. 6. Never give your real name to those that approach you. 7. If you feel unsafe, end your shift and make your way home. And 8. Never take the same way home twice in a row. I experienced a series of events while working in the middle of the night. We'll start with what I believe might have been a deer or deer people. This led me to find swamp dwellers' retellings, mountains with stories surround Utah. I was making a delivery in one of the surrounding mountains. I noticed that the typical light pollution that hovers around most of the bigger cities in the area had dissipated. I had to drive roughly 20 minutes to get to the right neighborhood. I stopped across the street from the house, and I needed to make the drop-off. I looked down momentarily to grab the order, and I opened the door. Then, stepping out of the car, my gaze met the two eyes of a deer standing no more than 2 feet away from me. Now, I'm 5'11", so I'm typically taller than the deer around here. However, there was no reflection in this deer's black eyes, not even a glimmer of my car's headlights, which lit up the road around it. I broke from the gaze and decided to continue making my delivery when I noticed 6 of these large deer standing around my car, staring at me while standing still. I subconsciously held my breath as I turned and headed across the street and I made my delivery. I started breathing again as I handed the customer their order, and neither one of us said a word about the deer staring at my back as I was turned to them. The customer and I had the same wide-eyed look, and they quickly went back inside. I took a deep breath to work up the courage to turn around, and I turned to see the deer had moved onto the yard that wasn't even 1 foot from my car. But they kept their eyes locked on me as I quickly walked back to my car. I felt like it took me years to reach my car. As my hand touched the handle of my car, the house's lights, that were all just previously off, it started flickering like a strobe light, each light flickering at different speeds with no end in sight. This didn't seem to bother the deer as they held their gaze, and a sense of dread washed over me like a giant wave crashing into my body and set my heart rate flying. I practically dove into my car and began to back out of the spot that my car was settled into, careful not to hit any of these supposed deer. I made my way out of there as quickly as I could. All the while, the deer heads followed my movement while their bodies stood still, like statues. I wasn't relieved of the dread that I felt until I was back in the brightly lit city. After I got home, I looked up not deer stories to see if this encounter matched any other experiences. I came across the Letters from a Cryptid Hunter series and enjoyed all of Swamp Dweller's videos and storytellings. I realized I have quite a few creepy and odd stories from driving in the middle of the night, and figured I would tell my experiences to you. This one may not be as creepy to some, but man, it was to me. The order I received took me to some apartments that I've delivered to many times before and several times after, but this encounter only happened this one time. Sometimes the animals that you're used to regularly seeing can be just as bizarre and as chilling as cryptids. I pulled up to the apartment complex and nothing seemed ordinary for this delivery. Still, much to my surprise, as I rounded a corner, I was thankful that apartments usually have a low speed limit, and I was only going about 10 miles an hour. The street was filled with stray cats, and I'm not talking about 10 or even 20. There were so many, I couldn't even begin to try and count them all, and I wouldn't be able to drive past them. My car halted, and the cats' heads snapped to my location, all in sync with each other. I threw my car into park and turned on my hazard lights. Once I was out of the car, preparing to make my way around all of these cats, they stood and sat calmly in peace, not making a single sound. Usually, feral cats will hiss, growl, meow, or scatter into hiding spaces when strangers approach, and I already knew these cats were not local to this complex, so they shouldn't be used to people. And yet, they just watched as I walked around them, not wanting to get too close, because if they all decided to get territorial together, then they could do some serious damage, and I had an order to deliver. The air felt stagnant and thick with unease. They followed a few feet behind me for a few steps until I got closer to the building that I needed to be at. I made my delivery and started on my way back to my car, and once again, I was met with this horde of cats watching and following as I walked, as if to ensure that I was leaving. The atmosphere felt like I had interrupted an important business meeting. Going through the lot, I felt my skin crawl most uncomfortably. I haven't been met with that number of cats ever since. For this experience, it'll be helpful to know that I have a phobia of lightning and thunder, so I tend to be hyper aware of the weather. If there's a storm, I'll count the distance between the lightning to the thunder to try and get an idea of how far the storm is from my location. This particular night started with clear skies, but anyone in Utah knows that that can change in minutes. In my area, lightning will jump around the sky, not staying in one spot. My destination was leading me up into one of the towns that rest at the base of a mountain. I noticed in the distance flashes of light coming from the direction that I was headed in. I didn't hear any thunder, so I figured it was quite the distance out, and there was no rain that I could see, and not even a cloud in the sky. Even still, I gripped the wheel a bit tighter and started some breathing exercises to calm myself down so that I could finish up with the order that I had. The town is spaced enough between houses that small woodlands surrounded the homes, and only one small road leads into the neighborhoods. I was making my way around the bend of the road when a clash of light shot off to the left, right above the woodlands next to my car, and the sky flashed a pale blue as the branches of electricity reached out all around the sky, making everything in the area bathe in the blinding light. I slowed my car down and chills shot down my spine, making every hair on my body stand on end. I started counting out of habit because I didn't hear or feel any sign of thunder when the lightning shot out. Then, just like clockwork, when I got to the count of 7, another flash of lightning lit up the sky, with an identical pattern sweeping through the night in the same place and just as silent as the last one. Every 7 seconds, another would strike like a rhythmic metronome, always on time and identical to each other with no thunder. Getting out of the car, the air tasted of electricity, as if I had just licked the static from an old TV. I quickly finished my delivery and I ended my shift, each flash of lightning threatening to strike me right where I stood. The flashes continued as I made my way down the mountain, and I didn't relax until I was far away from that area. It was about 4 a.m., and I pulled into an area of the mountain that I don't like delivering to. The atmosphere always feels like impending doom is taking over the city. It's technically a city, but it looks more like an abandoned town, especially at night. The streets have maybe one dim light placed every few miles, making the roads dark
and bleak. My boyfriend rode along with me for my deliveries, and we can call him S. I pulled onto the street where the customer resides. It's a new build/development area with many houses yet to be finished. The customer asked me to hand them the order rather than leave it on the porch. So, when I reached the house, I sent him a text saying I was outside with their order. Customers usually wait outside or by the door when they ask me to hand them their charges. I didn't get a response, so after about a minute, I called them and I was sent to voicemail. I left them a message to let them know that I was outside with their order and asked if they would still like for me to hand it to them or if they would instead prefer me to leave it at the door. The porch and garage lights were on and lighting up the house, so I chose to walk up to the house and leave the order at their door if I didn't get a response from them. I noticed they had a doorbell camera, so I waited on the porch for a moment in case the camera would notify them that someone was at their door. I still had no response from the customer, so I put the order on the porch and I took a picture and sent the customer a detailed message of where I left the order, and just as I was waiting for the message to confirm that it was sent, I started to hear a haunting whistling tune. I turned my gaze back to the doorbell camera, thinking that maybe the customer was trying to get my attention. However, I noticed the whistle wasn't coming from the direction of the door. The whistle rang through my right ear and sounded like it was coming from the trees to the right of the driveway. I walked over to the driveway, looking around the corner of the house to see if the customer was coming from that direction, but I was met with a garage door a few feet back from where I was standing. I froze in place as I saw no one in sight, and the whistled tune sounded as if it was being made next to my ears. I have no idea how long I had been standing frozen there, but it must have been a considerable amount of time because S had rolled down his window. As he did, the whistling stopped. I snapped out of my trance when S shouted, "Are you okay?" I realized it had been much longer than 1 minute per rule number 2, and I ran back to my car without saying a word. I got in the car with rough, panicked breathing, turned toward S, and finally spoke. "Were you whistling while I was out there?" I felt sick to my stomach as he replied. He said, "No, you were acting strange and looked spooked, so I just rolled down the window to see if you were okay, but I didn't hear anything." As he said this, I realized that everything else was silent besides the whistling. No chirping from the crickets or yelps from any coyotes that frequently roam the area. Just silence. We were both spooked and agreed that we needed to get out of there, hoping we wouldn't get another order to bring us back to that creepy place. The events that took place during this story give me shivers to this day. Everything had been pretty routine through this evening, and I had finished my shift and decided to get some food for myself. I only had to wait a few minutes to receive my burrito through the drive-thru and started driving home. It was around 4 a.m. when the power for 2 cities, including the one I was currently in, shut off. The usual buzz of streetlights, the sounds of passing cars, and all the other regular noise of the city suddenly stopped. When a forest goes dead quiet, it's chilling and defiantly fear-inducing, for good reasons, but for me, when a busy city that is constantly noisy goes dead quiet, it's very concerning and terrifying. It felt like I was the only living soul for miles around. I would have been concerned that I would have gone deaf if it weren't for the radio still quietly playing the podcast that I was listening to. By this point, I had reduced my speed to a slow crawl. Nothing about this felt right. I was on high alert, straining to hear any noise from outside my car, fearing that I might have gotten into a dangerous situation. The road I was on has quite a few open fields around both sides and is more uncommonly used.
It was parallel to a busy highway that's typically quite loud as cars drive on it 24/7, yet I couldn't hear a single car pass. The skies were clear and the weather was good until what looked like a thick, pitch-black fog rolled into the area and surrounded my car. I could only see about 5 feet out and around my car. I slowly continued to make my way down the road until I spotted a police car, and shortly after, a vehicle was smashed to pieces. The left side of the car had been crushed inward, and bits of the vehicle scattered around the road. There were no signs of an accident. It looked like this car was smashed and dropped into the middle of a road. I looked around and I didn't see a single person, like the area had just been abandoned. I started to step on the brake and was going to get out of the car when I felt death emanating from around me. Being sensitive to spirits or ghosts, whatever you prefer, I heard a faint voice come from my passenger seat. "If you step out of this car, you will die." My stomach was ready to vomit on the spot, so I composed myself and I continued to drive. Once I got onto the main road, the fog cleared and all of the noise returned outside. The power was still out, but it was a typical night. I still feel uneasy when driving down that road, but I'm not quite sure what I encountered that night, and I haven't seen any news or reports of accidents at that location. This first story is called Mall Santa. About 10 years ago, I graduated college. I couldn't find any immediate work and I got desperate around Christmas. So, I took on the iconic role of Santa Claus at my local mall. But since Christmas is probably my favorite holiday, I never had a problem getting into character. And thanks to my love for pizza and beer, I've never had a problem looking the part either. All it took was the addition of one of those glossy fake white beards and the iconic red suit itself, and I was making myself feel festive just by looking in the mirror. I had the voice down, the costume, the beard, and if I'm being honest, I was pretty damn proud of how good of a Santa I was. Outside of the holiday season, I now work as an admin assistant for a shipping company. Not exactly the most exciting job in the world, but hey, it pays all right. So when the annual opportunity to don the red suit and make some kids smile comes around, I jump at the chance. However, during my time on the job, the most valuable lesson I learned was that you can never, ever promise the kids anything. Some children ask for unrealistic gifts for Christmas, and some are just impossible to procure, like, "I want a dragon, or a horse, or a tank." But sometimes they'll ask for other things that are a little more sensible, just way out of their parents' holiday budget. So I'd learned to give them my best, "Santa will try his very best for you," before moving the topic of conversation onto something else. Christmas last year was rough, though, mainly because I had decided to make it the final one that I would be playing Santa. But it was for other reasons, too. I developed quite the working relationship with some of the mall employees, both short and long term, so it was pretty emotional when I announced that I'd be hanging up the Santa hat to spend more time with my family around the holidays. Anyway, Friday, December 22nd, was my last shift before the switchover to the new guy playing Santa Claus, and the mall was way busier than expected. Of course, it always gets pretty hectic the closer you get to Christmas, but even I'd never seen anything like it in all the years I'd been playing the role. The final day of festivities was quickly the toughest one to date, as I knew I'd be moving on from playing Santa after that day. I know this seems suspect, but most people feel liberated when they leave a job like that. But at the risk of sounding, you know, sappy, I didn't have many good Christmases growing up, so I felt like a lot of the festive spirit was me making up for lost time. They say that time flies when you're having fun, and never a more accurate word has been spoken.
The last day flew by quicker than I could have expected. One minute, it was lunchtime, and the next, the sun had set, and it was fast approaching the time when I'd have to wrap everything up. But just as I was beginning to leave, I noticed a little girl slowly walking towards me. "Why, hello there, little one. And where are your parents?" I kept the voice on, giving her my warmest Santa smile. And she didn't say a word. She just gave me this tired look and kept walking towards me with her arms aloft, as if she wanted to be picked up. I looked around for her parents, but I didn't see anybody with her. So I picked the little girl up and plopped her down on my lap, just as I'd done 1,000 times before. "And what might your name be, young lady?" My name is Holly." "Holly? Well, I never. What an adorably festive name. The Holly and the Ivy is one of my favorite Christmas songs, by the way. May I ask what your last name is, Holly?" "Donicky. It's Donicky." I nodded to the nearby mall security to have the word Holly Donicky broadcasted over the mall speaker system. That way, her parents would come find her, and no doubt they'd be apprehensive at this point. But all while this was happening, I would keep her company. "And what is it that Santa can get you for Christmas, Holly?" Again, she didn't answer. Instead, she looked off into the distance as if she were staring at nothing. Like the thousand-yard stare you'd hear about in Nam vets having, she then looked up at me with the saddest blue-green eyes that I'd ever seen. She said, "All I want for Christmas is a friend." I was dumbstruck. In all my years of playing Santa Claus, I'd never had any kids say they wanted a friend for Christmas. It was heart-wrenching, and all I could think to do was just pat her head. "Well, I can be your friend. Santa Claus will always be your friend, Holly, and I'm sure a little girl as lovely as you will have no trouble finding a friend." She gave me a weak smile. She hugged me and then hopped off my lap. I tried to stop her from running off, but I was hesitant to grab at her arm. I didn't want to upset her. I called her name a few times, but she didn't seem to listen. She just disappeared into the crowds of festive shoppers. I tried to follow her, but there was no sign of her, so I asked if anyone had seen a little girl about 4 feet tall with long brown hair, those almost luminous blue-green eyes, and a kind of shabby appearance. Not a single person had any idea what I was talking about. It took a few minutes for members of mall security staff to wade through the sea of people and made it to Santa's grotto. They worried when I told them that she had run off into the department store. "Have any parents shown up looking for her?" I asked. He said, "Nah, no one. Maybe she just wandered here after getting out of the house. The parents don't even know to look here." I was getting increasingly anxious as time passed, but after a thorough search of the mall and some intense studying of the CCTV cameras, there were no signs of little Holly. It was like she dropped off the face of the earth. I suppose that should have been the last of it, but I couldn't keep this little girl off my mind for some reason. The way she acted when I questioned her about her parents, compared to how forthcoming she was with all the other stuff I asked her, left kind of a terrible taste in my mouth. So, one morning, after a dog walk and a little breakfast, I sat at my computer and plugged the little girl's name into Google. I don't quite know what I was expecting to find. Nothing, if I'm being honest, but what I did find horrified me. December 23rd, desperate mother pleads for return of missing girl. 9-year-old Holly Grace Donicky was reported missing by her mother, Lily Rose Donicky. At the time of her disappearance, the little girl was wearing a blue and white dress and white tights and had her hair in bunches. She's approximately 4 feet 2 inches tall, weighs 60 pounds, and has brown hair and blue-green eyes. If you have information regarding the whereabouts of any missing person, please contact the Suffolk County Police Department at the phone number provided. I was stunned. I just saw her a few weeks before, on the 22nd. Maybe it was a typo, but the more I researched, the more uneasy I became. The following article sent shivers down my spine. January 4th, breaking. The remains of the missing 9-year-old girl, Holly Donaghy, were found today, January 4th, in a wooded area about 3 miles away from her family home. Suffolk County Police are investigating the cause of death, which appears to be an act of foul play. Holly was gone. She died just a few weeks after I met her, and all she ever wanted was a friend. This next story is called My Mall Security Nightmare. This story happened to me in December of 2018. I'm a recent Navy veteran and have seen and dealt with many situations that made it so I get scared easily. Just some insight on me. I'm now a 28-year-old male, I've got an athletic build, and I'm ready to take on the world since leaving the military. For this story, we'll just say my name is Ron. I started working as a security guard in a Michigan mall, which I won't name in this story, and I loved my job and the people that I worked with. The night of the 23rd, I was to work my first overnight shift, which only consisted of one officer, for about 8 or 9 hours. I didn't think much of it, so I clock in for my shift at 10 p.m. and I prepare everything for the night. On my first rove through the mall, I verified that all the doors were locked, I made sure no one was in the mall, and I hit all my checkpoints. The night is running smooth. Around 2 a.m., I start making my way around the mall again to do another check. I'm making my way to Center Court, where we have our Santa set up, and as I round the corner, I freeze in what I can only describe as pure terror. About 30 feet from me, I can see and smell a homeless man wearing a Santa hat, holding a machete in one hand and what looks to be like a club in the other. He had this evil look on his face, like he was there to do one thing: kill me. I just froze. I was sitting there, running over what to do. All I had was a radio and some handcuffs. I didn't want to fight this man with two weapons, but I knew I could outrun him to the safety of my locked office. I knew all the shortcuts and the back halls like the back of my hand. Then an arcade game started playing music, catching the guy off guard as he took his eyes off me just for a second. And once he did that, I made a run for it. As I'm running, I hear him behind me, "Get back here, you son of a... you're mine." Not once did I stop. I ran, I dodged corners, and I bounded through the halls as fast as possible. I make the final turn to the hallway that my office was in. I had one chance to type my lock code in the door, get in, and then shut the door before he called me. I finally reached the door and could still hear him as he was now laughing hysterically. I quickly and flawlessly punch my code in, I hop in the office, and I slam the door shut. There's only a second of quiet before he starts banging on the door. I thank God it was a reinforced door. Suddenly, the banging stops. I go to the monitors and he's standing in front of the door, not moving an inch. "Mr. Security Guard, come on out and let's make this fast. It will only hurt for a second." I'm freaked out at this point because his intentions are clear. I don't know why I didn't call the police, and I know I should have. I decided to wait him out. An hour goes by and he hasn't moved. I feel safe in the office, but eventually, people will start showing up to open up their shops. I have to do something. I finally called the police, and they said they have an office right down the street. I was so thankful when I heard sirens and watched the man run out of there. I watched him on the cameras, and he ran into two massive linebacker-like officers. He never stood a chance. After that night, I refused to work the night shift, and I left that job 2 months later. But I will never forget that night or that voice. It will only hurt for a second.